Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. Today in the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a discussion about whether or not to ban tear gas in Albany. Then we learn about upstander training as a way to take action and de-escalate racism when we see it on the streets from Carlin Cowan. Later on, we talk with participants of the Sustainable Futures Conference, first hearing from Heather Ipson, and later from RPI student Emily Birkenmeyer, who is part of the Youth Congress at the conference. And we end with a segment on the arts and hear from poet, actor, playwright, and stage director Carol Durant. But first, here are the headlines.
Jurors have reached a decision in the trial of fired Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, charged with killing George Floyd. Derek Chauvin has been found guilty on all three charges of second-degree murder, second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter.
Albany County Executive Dan McCoy said there are more than 1,900 COVID-19 vaccine appointments available Thursday at the Times Union Center in Albany.
The Assembly Health Committee approved the single-payer Medicare for All legislation this week. The bill has passed the Assembly in recent years, but not moved in the state Senate. A majority of senators now sponsor the New York health bill, leading advocates to hope this is the year that the measure finally passes.
A new poll released by Siena College shows that New York voters are very concerned about the climate and believe stronger environmental action will help the economy. 78% of voters support the goal of getting 100% of its electricity from clean energy by 2040. Voters also support redesigning cities to be more pedestrian-friendly.
David Bryce is proposing to tear down Troy's downtown Uncle Sam atrium and replace it with 60 apartments, a 400-space parking garage, and a commercial development. The 1979 atrium project never gained traction as a shopping site, and the city's planning commission will review the proposal on Wednesday.
The Gazette reports that Schenectady city officials want to take a similar path as Albany in targeting off-road motorcycles and all-terrain vehicles used on city streets and parks. Albany more than quadrupled the cost of reclaiming an impounded dirt bike or ATV recently to $3,000.
The entrance to the Schenectady police station on Liberty Street, where protesters last week wrote in chalk, broke a glass panel, is now surrounded by temporary fencing. Police officials say that it was a precautionary step until it can explore other options. Residents were protesting the killing of Dante Wright by the police in Minnesota.
Comptroller Tom DiNapoli last week requested Attorney General Letitia James launch an investigation into whether Governor Andrew Cuomo used state resources when writing his book about the COVID-19 pandemic last year. The letter from DiNapoli to James grants her office the authority to investigate the circumstances surrounding the book development.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
For our first story tonight, the Albany Common Council decided to table its legislation to ban tear gas in Albany after discussion about the ways in which the ban had been watered down as of late. The city administration had worked against the legislation and a great public outcry against the increasingly militaristic stance of policing in general. HMM's Paul Smart brings us this report.
Can you please read the communications from the mayor's office?
Yes, Mr. President. We applaud the council's desire to address our community's concerns about the use of tear gas and other non-lethal force by the Albany Police Department. We owe it to our residents to ensure we have their trust that APD is not using tear gas or other non-lethal force indiscriminately. While our research has failed to find a single city or state in the country has adopted the restrictions contemplated in the legislation currently being considered by the council, we strongly support legislation that would restrict and control the use of tear gas and other non-lethal force, including restricting use to when a riot is declared as defined by New York state law, requiring a police chief or deputy chief to order its use, requiring two notifications to the public in the immediate vicinity tear gas is about to be used, requiring an EMT to be on site prior to its deployment, prohibiting its use in residential neighborhoods unless absolutely necessary to protect lives. In the last 32 years, tear gas has been used outdoors by the Albany Police Department only twice, on May 30th, 2020 and June 1st, 2020, after members of the Albany Police Department were assaulted with bricks, Molotov cocktails, fireworks, police vehicles were damaged, a police horse was burned, and police equipment was stolen. A complete ban on tear gas will create a situation where, should City Hall be attacked by armed insurrectionists, similar to what we saw at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, the Albany Police Department will face the choice of doing nothing or using lethal force. We urge the Common Council to include common sense amendments that will keep our community safe and address our shared desire to ensure tear gas is used only when absolutely necessary to protect against mass violence.
The previous statement was read at last night's Albany Common Council meeting held on Zoom as protesters continued to camp out in front of the Albany Police Department South Station, where officers utilized pepper spray during a rally last week in support of a complete ban on tear gas and other militaristic means of policing by the city. We go now to the discussion that preceded this reading, wherein council members discussed the matter and decided to send their proposed ban on tear gas, which Mayor Kathy Sheehan has vowed to veto, back to committee discussion.
I support banning tear gas. I do. I support it. I got a whiff of that last year. And I have not been in the best of health since I got the tear gas last year in my eyes, and I have crystals in my lungs. Now, I do want to ban it, but I'm asking Judy, what are you planning on replacing this with?
So it's not a matter of what I'm going to replace it with. It's what the administration should be doing. Where are these best practices that the mayor has suggested that, the U.S. Conference of Mayors and other people? I've gotten no response to that. But I did go to the U.S. Conference of Mayors website myself. What the U.S. Conference of Mayors report talks about, first and foremost, is that police officers should be well-trained and educated about First Amendment freedoms. They should be trained in helping people exert their First Amendment rights, not standing in the way, not getting nervous because people are protesting. This is part of our democracy. They don't mention, in their summary, they don't mention tear gas. What they talk about then in terms of escalating processes is then moving, and hopefully you avoid this, but moving to arrests, moving to documentation of what people are doing that is illegal in the crowd, removing people who are acting inappropriately, who are engaging in criminal activity, removing them from the crowd, and thereby protecting the other protesters. All of that is, we've seen some evidence of that in the city of Albany at times, but we don't have the police chief and the mayor talking about those techniques. And this is part of the problem with the whole conversation about police reform.
I hear all that. But how come I'm afraid for my community? I'm afraid for the lower wards. This, I was there last year. I'm still feeling the effects of it. I would love to ban tear gas, but how come we can't go back to the drawing board? We're going to leave no teeth into this thing. Let's sit down and hold the mayor and the chief to the fire, hand to the fire. I'm afraid for my community. My community is asking me to draw this thing until we could sit down ourselves and hold the mayor and the chief responsible for what has not been done.
So I believe, I hear you. I believe that by passing this, we are then forcing the administration to be real about what are the alternatives available. I think it's a very dangerous thing for us to now be telling the community we're going to back down, we're going to water down the recommendations. I think the time is now for real police reform. Last year, we had two very significant tension-filled demonstrations at the Capitol with Oath Keepers and Proud Boys, et cetera. Tear gas was not used. You are using this discriminately in communities of color against people, against predominantly people of color, and that's unacceptable.
I agree with Councilwoman Love. I think she's made an excellent suggestion. And I think it's unfair to characterize what Councilwoman Love said as backing down or watering down. None of us is opposed to limiting the use of tear gas. I think that's exactly what everybody who has concerns about this particular legislation as it's written. And I think we really are kind of pushing one solution when maybe there's a lot of solutions.
I think first and foremost, this is an incredibly important discussion, and especially after the events of last summer and the broader discussion over police conduct and their interaction with our communities. Part of what we do is problem solving. I think that if we do vote on this tonight, what we're actually doing is delaying a common sense solution. I agree with Joyce on this, and I would like to actually have this worked on some more. And I would also point out that this should be a learning moment for all of us. I understand why this was advanced through the committee, but we really need to actually finish legislation fully before it goes through a committee.
So with all of you know, what we just discussed, just a show of hands, who wants to, you know, have more time and work through this? And it wouldn't be a meeting of the Public Safety Committee. It's going to be the whole council, because this is an issue that we all have to. Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Wait, I'm sorry. What are we raising hands for?
Whose desires to go back? Well, not go back to the drawing board, but to have a further discussion on this. Okay.
Kelly, can I just, so I'm listening to everybody and I'm really, really struggling with this. While I don't want to be disrespectful, I think that the public deserves an up or down vote on this particular piece of legislation. And then people can, you know, if it goes down, then people can work the problem. But I am very concerned about some of the police chief and the mayor's comments with regard to the continued justification and the not honoring the process, not honoring the report, not honoring the work of the people.
Meanwhile, protesters continued their actions in front of APD's South Station as the Common Council moved on to other issues, including housing and equity development, including the just-announced establishment of a new market for the South End on the site of the former McDonald's. This has been Paul Smart working with Moses Nagel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
To look at some of the groundwork laid so far in the way of police reform and reinvention collaborative, visit the mayor's office page at albanynewyork.gov.
Upstander training aims to empower people to take action to step in, de-escalate and prevent bullying, harassments, and violence against the Asian community. Corinne Cowan speaks to HMM's Eileen Javier about how this training can be utilized to assist other vulnerable communities like the LGBTQIA, Black and Brown, and Native Americans.
Hello, this is Eileen Javier for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We are talking to Carleen Cohen, the Chief Policy and Public Affairs Officer for the Chinese American Planning Council. Can you tell us what is your role at the Chinese American Planning Council?
Yes, thank you so much for having me today. So the Chinese American Planning Council, or CPC, is the nation's largest Asian American social services agency. So we provide services to about 60,000 Asian American, immigrant, and low-income New Yorkers each year in all five boroughs of New York City. And I do our policy and public affairs work. So that means that I work on public policy issues at the city and at New York State level that impact our community members, everything from immigrant justice to healthcare access to ensuring that there are adequate services for our community members.
Okay. I would like to speak about an initiative that you have at your organization, which is the bystander trainings. Can you please tell us the difference between being a bystander and an bystander?
That's an incredibly important question right now, particularly as we're seeing the rise in anti-Asian harassment and violence. As you probably know, we've seen that over the last year in New York State, anti-Asian hate crimes have gone up by 933%. And so that's an extremely concerning rise in incidents. And that's where a lot of this talk about bystanders and upstanders becomes really important as we all think about what is our own role in keeping our neighbors safe. So a bystander is somebody that bears witness to an incident, whether it is verbal harassment, whether it is physical harassment or violence, and they can play a very important role because they, in bearing witness to it, might record it, they might be able to alert the authorities or seek medical attention. But an upstander is someone that's actually empowered to take action and intervene in a lot of cases to even prevent the incident from beginning to begin with, or from keeping the incident from escalating into something even more serious.
Okay. What type of training is involved in learning to be an upstander?
It's really about empowering people to feel like they have the tools and resources that they need to step in. For a lot of folks, the idea of intervening in a scenario like this can feel very scary. There might be fears for their own safety, fears for not knowing how to handle the situation, or any other type of fear, which is completely understandable. But upstander training really gives people the tools and resources and helps people plan different scenarios that they might come across so that when they do end up coming across a incident of harassment or bullying of any kind, that they actually feel prepared because they have those tools and resources to fall back on and they know how they can intervene. And we've actually seen out of data that a lot of times when upstanders know how to intervene early on, it actually prevents an incident of harassment, whether it's anti-Asian violence, harassment, gender-based harassment, or anything like that, from happening at all.
Can you talk about being an upstander in relation to the current aggressions happening in your community?
Yes, it's so important right now because really what we need is more upstanders to help address this issue. What we know is that, you know, our community members in the Asian American community are facing verbal harassment, physical violence, threats, and other types of anti-Asian bias and violence as they're going about their daily lives. So it's happening at work, it's happening on the way to school, it's happening as people go to the grocery or go to church. And that means that because it's happening in all of these public places, the thing that is most likely to keep people safe is other people around them. And so sometimes we see that in, for example, preventative measures like safe walks, where somebody actually accompanies somebody else. Particularly, we've seen it with elders, but really anybody that just feels like they need to get somewhere safely, where a couple of neighbors actually accompany them to that place and make sure they arrive safely. But otherwise, when people are trained as upstanders, they might see something even just when they're, for example, walking around the grocery store or just in any part of public life, and they would be able to intervene and keep an incident from getting worse.
I think we should pay more attention, not only record, but react in a way that we are helpful. How can a school support a society of upstanders?
This is, I think, a particularly important thing for schools to deal with, because we know that bullying is a huge problem in schools. And as schools try to address that, and whether it is, you know, the kind of typical bullying that we see among younger children, whether it is anti-Asian bullying, which we've heard a lot of from our parents in our community members and our young people as well, or whether it's gender-based bullying, it's incredibly important for schools to teach young people to be upstanders. And in fact, people at quite a young age can become upstanders. That first goes to instilling the culture that we shouldn't just observe while these things happen, or we shouldn't just sit by and let these things happen, but rather that we as neighbors, as friends, as schoolmates are empowered to intervene safely and prevent them from happening. So the first thing I think is for schools to really instill that culture of, as a student, you don't sit by and watch something like that happen, but then actually helping young people to feel empowered to address these issues in their schools.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice about how teachers can encourage upstanding behavior in their students?
Absolutely. So I think that there's a few important things here. And one of the really big ones is upstanding training. So knowing what to actually look for and what to do, because as you mentioned earlier, one of the first important steps is actually looking around us more, right? It can be really easy, whether we're in school or whether we're just traveling to work, to be paying attention to ourselves, what's going on with our own lives. And so learning how to practice what we call situational awareness, which is a sense of what's going on around you and with the people around you, is an incredibly important first step. Because if you don't even notice an incident happening, you're certainly not going to be able to intervene in it. And then the second is that set of tools of how to actually intervene in an incident. And there are a number of incredible organizations that do this training. There may be some locally where you are. There's certainly a number in New York State and then a number nationally where you can learn tactics of how to intervene, from how to distract people that might be engaging in an incident like this, to how to draw their attention away into something else safely, all while keeping yourself safe. Because of course, we want to make sure that anyone that's an upstander is consenting into that and is constantly making sure that they themselves are safe in addition to the person that they're trying to support.
Makes sense. Is upstander training something that our listeners can participate in?
Absolutely. Upstander training is something that you can get at one of your local community-based organizations. You can do it online in your pajamas on a Zoom training. And it is incredibly empowering. There are, you know, different methods, of course, but any number of trainers that are trained in upstander training, what we might call de-escalation, situational awareness, can even in just an hour give you some really good techniques for how to observe when these incidents are happening, and then ways to judge whether you can safely intervene and then how to actually do so. Of course, you can take much more extensive trainings, but even just an hour of your time can get you a little bit more empowered than you were before to identify and intervene.
We are talking to Carleen Cohen, the Chief Policy and Public Affairs Officer for the Chinese American Planning Council. Carleen, what else should our listeners know about upstander training?
I think that something else to keep in mind about upstander training is that, you know, right now we're talking about upstanders in terms of anti-Asian harassment and violence. And there's some really important specific contexts around race and the history of anti-Asianness in the United States that go into that. And really considering that as we do what we call like being culturally competent about understanding the context of how we are being upstanders. And at the same time, it's also important to remember that upstanders are needed in a variety of situations. And we discussed some of these already. In schools, when kids are being bullied, we see gender-based harassment that happens on the street. Harassment is certainly something that impacts other marginalized communities, from communities of color to LGBTQ communities. And so while it's really helpful that we learn the historical context and understand kind of what's going into, for example, right now, anti-Asian violence, that upstander training can be used to help all of our neighbors around us, really regardless. And it's just an incredibly versatile thing that we can use that keeps our community safer, because when we take care of each other, the entire community is safer.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. Thank you for your interest in upstander training, and I definitely look forward to staying in touch.
That was HMM's Eileen Javier speaking with Carlin Cohen, who is part of the Chinese American Planning Council, and she gave us the information that you can find upstander training in your local community organization, or you can find more information about the Chinese American Planning Council programs at cpc-nyc.org.
For those just tuning in, I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have any comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. Heather Ipson, the Innovation and Performance Specialist of the City of Schenectady, will lead a breakout session at the Sustainable Futures Conference called The Greening of Schenectady. She spoke with HMM's Mark Dunley about her work and about the upcoming conference.
We're talking with Heather Ipson, who is the Innovation and Performance Specialist for the City of Schenectady. And this is another one of our previews of the upcoming Sustainable Future Conference, which is taking place from April 27th to April 30th, virtually at www.sustainablefuturesconference.com. And Heather, on the first day, is helping to do a workshop, I believe at 1 p.m., on the greening of Schenectady. So, Heather, why don't we start off maybe just a quick introduction. What do you do for the City of Schenectady?
Hi, everybody. I am the Innovation and Performance Specialist with the City of Schenectady. And essentially, in that role, I kind of wear a couple different hats. One of them is data analysis. So I kind of look at all the data from different departments within the city, and I analyze their performance based on kind of what they're looking to track over time. And then I also am a co-leader on sustainability projects with my coworker, Avi Epstein. And we head up the Climate Smart Communities Task Force, which is a lot of what I'll be talking about at the Sustainable Futures Conference. And then aside from that, I also do a lot of mapping and application building with the software that we have called Esri ArcGIS. And that's just basically a mapping software that helps with spatial analysis of all the data that I was talking about before.
So what will you be talking about at the workshop you're doing on, I believe, April 27th?
So at the workshop, I'm going to be focusing on the different sustainability projects that we have done and that we're going to do, as well as the challenges that we've kind of faced with our forward progress so far, and kind of what we're anticipating in the future as well. And I'm hoping to have a good conversation with folks that attend my session about kind of where they might see that we could go to.
So what are some of the things that, you know, sustainability covers, say, for the City of Schenectady? I assume it probably covers some stuff on energy, maybe on solid waste. Do you get into procurement practices, you know, what type of paper or other supplies departments are heading up? How do you maintain the buildings with pesticides and parks? You know, what goes into sustainability for a city?
Yeah, I think it's all kind of individual, really, what you want sustainability to mean, of course, right? But For us so far, we've focused largely on the energy components, I'd say. We've looked a lot into electric vehicle charging infrastructure, as well as how we can save energy. We've done a lot of investment in solar projects and that sort of thing. But I think we definitely need to expand our horizons and move into other spheres of sustainability, of course, too, like you mentioned, for procurement and that sort of thing, because we've been focusing so largely on the energy sector, which obviously is great. You know, it's a huge component of our carbon footprint. So it is important to focus on that. But I think expanding into other realms is a good idea moving forward.
So how new is sustainability, say, in the city of Schenectady? Has this been around for a while? Is this sort of a new project?
Actually, yeah, it's been around for a long time. It's not been highly publicized, I'll say, but they did originally, well before I came to the city, they had a advisory council that was approved by the council, and I'm forgetting the actual name of it, but they did have a group of individuals that were advising the council on sustainability matters, particularly with regards to energy. But that group kind of, I don't know why or how, sort of fizzled out. And our Climate Smart Communities Task Force, we're trying to kind of shuffle it into that role and kind of work as more of an advisory group over time, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. So yeah, sustainability has been around for quite a while, and I'm happy about that and happy to keep it going.
All cities, of course, have more things they want to do than they're able to afford to do. So, you know, are there cost restrictions, or has that been a major factor with sustainability, or does sustainability tend to pay for itself in cost savings?
Well, there are a number of really good grants that you can get from the federal government and state government. And so we've been able to take advantage of that, luckily, so far. And I think part of the reason that we've focused so much on the energy sector is because there are a lot of grant opportunities in that realm. So we are obviously, like I said, we're looking to expand elsewhere, but yeah, it is largely dependent on funding, and some of these things can be quite costly to start. But of course, obviously, there'll be a great payoff at the end, at the other end, or at least we would hope there is. But yeah, so it can be a little bit difficult. That's one of the challenges I'll speak to in the sustainability conference, is that it can be a little bit difficult to navigate the platforms that are required for the grants to actually get the money. They are very particular about what materials need to be submitted and how and when and all the deadlines. So it can be a lot to juggle, but there is a lot of funding available. It's just a matter of, can you get through the weeds to get the actual funding you need?
So what are some of the projects that you have done, you know, maybe most proud of, and what are some of your present initiatives?
Well, we just installed 10 charging stations behind City Hall that are all free and open to the public. And we're
charging stations for cars?
Yes, electric vehicle charging stations, yeah. And we worked with actually a local company to get those installed. So it's a new brand name, Livingston Energy. And that was quite a project. We started it right before COVID, so unfortunately it was delayed multiple times, but we did finally get it done. And I just submitted some paperwork to NYSERDA to get the funding to have that done. So hopefully now we can expand our electric vehicle fleet so that we can use those charging stations as well as city employees and all that.
Now, one of the topics of your workshop is, you know, how to make green work a priority for your municipality. So what are some of the points you'll be raising with that section?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a challenge to do that. I think it's mostly about knowing your audience and who you're trying to ask for assistance from and how sustainability can benefit them. I mean, really, it benefits everyone, of course, right? But it's about figuring out how you can pitch it to the people that you need help from. And I mean, I think it's almost as simple as that. But of course, you have to kind of tailor the message to whatever group you're speaking with, and then listen to the people that you're talking to too, and kind of figure out what they need from you as well. So it can be a two-way street in that way.
Yeah. You know, has there, you know, been any particular, you know, major surprises as you've taken on this job? They said, ha, I didn't realize, you know, something until I, you know, really began to delve into it.
I mean, yeah, I guess I didn't know so much about like the inner workings of local government and how the whole process works, and how you really can't just say like, all right, let's just build a solar array. You know, it's so much more complicated than that. You get to have to get approval from certain people. Like, a lot of things have to go through the council, and there's a whole much longer process behind projects, as opposed to just saying like, you know, you just want to do it and you just get the land and you just build it up. It's not always that simple. So there's always kind of another political element that goes into kind of everything. And I think that's a lot of why projects can go a little bit slower if they go through the government, unfortunately. But, you know, I guess it's not always a bad thing. So.
So Heather will be speaking about the Green in Schenectady at the Sustainable Futures Conference, which runs April 27th to April 30th, www.sustainablefuturesconference.com. I believe she's speaking 1 p.m. on the first day of the conference, April 27th. Heather, if people want to find out more about some of the work you're doing in Schenectady, do you guys have a webpage or anything?
We do, yep. It's thecityofschenectady.com, and there is a tab along the top that will take you to a sustainability page. It's under government, smart city project, and sustainability.
Well, thank you very much, Heather Ibsen, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
The Sustainable Futures Conference will take place from April 27th to 30th. To find out more more information can be found at www.sustainablefuturesconference.com.
Staying with the Sustainable Futures Conference, RPI student Emily Berkemeyer will be part of the Youth Congress. Emily spoke with Water Justice Fellow Chansanique Pollock about her involvement in climate activism on RPI's campus.
Hello, I'm Chansanique.
And I'm Genesis.
And we are the Water Justice Youth Fellows at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. This interview is a part of a series of interviews about the Youth Congress event at the Sustainable Future Conference,
which will take place online April 27th to the 30th.
Enjoy the interview.
Can you please introduce yourself with your name, age, and what school you go to?
Sure. My name is Emily Berkemeyer. I use she, they pronouns. I go to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and I am 19.
Can you just explain like what you do?
So basically, specifically this year, last year for the 51st student senate over at RPI, I was a student senator. My term just ended in March, so as a student senator, I was involved in a lot of different initiatives, but most notably with the Facilities and Services Committee. So basically that's on RPI, dedicated to making sure different facilities, like making sure that food waste, that was a big issue that I right now am still going after in a sense, because of quarantine, there was a lot of food waste, and just in general on college campuses, that's the main issue. And I'm also working on helping revitalize a garden on campus with them. And then I'm also, now I'm a student representative for my class. So a lot of that entails, you know, advocacy for students, because RPI sadly does not have a great track record of making sure students' rights are upheld and doing things in the best interest of their students. That's definitely something that is also paralleled in a lot of government and a lot of different organizations. So it's actually been interesting to see the parallels in like making sure that the Institute's administration like actually makes decisions in the best interest of like students, and like contacts us and has transparency, and also in my work as like a climate activist. And I'll go a bit into that. So basically I've been involved as a climate activist since I'd say about your grade, 10th grade. But I started in middle school with like basically a water organization at my middle school, because I'm from Long Island. So quality of water is definitely very important there, especially because there's a lot of issues with contamination of like the aquifer that's under Long Island, which is where we get all our water from. So from that, I joined a student-run organization for like our whole community. now it's called like Students for Climate Action, but when I was just started, it was pertaining to the specific county where I live, Suffolk County. So from that is how I've been very passionate about climate change for a while and climate activism. So I've been learning more throughout the years. And my freshman year last year, since I'm a sophomore now, I attended climate strikes and, you know, on and off attended different activism things in the capital region. But especially this semester, it's become a lot easier to get involved in climate stuff now that restrictions are lessening with COVID, you know, the vaccines are out. So we started a Sunrise chapter at RPI, which I'm involved in. So I've been doing stuff in regards to that. And then that is how I found out about the Youth Congress for Climate and Justice. And we have those meetings on Thursdays. So we have one in 2 days. I'm excited for it. I'm going to be the facilitator for that meeting. We change off who is the facilitator every meeting, because the whole idea of what we're doing is we don't want it just to be like a centralized hierarchy. Like, it's a collaborative movement, you know, in building this conference. And the conference is going to be collaborative. Like, I'm very excited for it, even though it is during basically my finals week, because I have a lot of essays due that week. But yeah, I'm definitely excited to get more pumped up again. And as things reopen, it's going to be a lot easier to like have these, you know, have rallies, have things where people can talk in person, because it's possible to do climate activism online. And definitely, you know, I've been involved in phone banks and email banks, you know, just bombarding people with emails. And most recently, New York Renews, we did the teachers' divestment day, basically trying to get the New York State teachers, their retirement fund is still like based in fossil fuels. So we want them to divest from that. So I've been involved with them recently, but I'm excited to attend the conference and see how it turns out.
Going back to the Youth Congress, why do you think it's important that all these groups and youth are coming together to talk about climate change and other issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. So being involved in, you know, climate activism, after you get like a couple of years under your belt, and even it doesn't even have to be a couple of years, the more you learn, the more hopeless it seems, and the more ingrained these systems feel like, as you start to realize, well, it's not just, oh, save the earth. It has to do with problems within society, like how our society is structured around capitalism and systemic racism and all those different aspects. And it does feel very hopeless. So I think it's extremely important for young people to realize that, you know, we're not alone, that there are a lot of different people from different walks of life who understand this is an issue and who want to work towards making our concerns a reality. And that's why I'm very excited for this conference, because we want to make sure we, in our planning meetings, we make sure that we're not just an echo chamber. You know, we don't want that at all. We want to have a space where people of all different sort of levels of knowledge with climate activism and social justice can come in and learn from each other. Because even somebody who just started their journey on like on the whole road of learning about climate activism and environmental justice issues, like they still have a story, and they have expertise that they can bring to the table. And it's so important that we get all those voices together and make a plan to actually engage in action and create action, because there's so many passionate people. So many people I know are like, wow, you know, climate change is really bad, I'm scared, but they don't know where to start. They don't know what to do and how to make it better. So I think having everybody, I know having people together, that's how movements start, you know, people building on ideas and forming ideas and creating like an understanding of like, okay, these are our goals. They might be slightly different, but our main goal, our main focus is to, in this case, to make sure that climate issues are addressed, and like these social issues that are intrinsically entwined with these climate issues are also addressed as soon as possible. So I'm excited for new people to kind of get engaged and for myself to get re-engaged and re-inspired, because with the pandemic, it was very hard, you know. My spring semester, I was very excited. Okay, like right now I can finally get more involved. I've scheduled out things, I understand how college works, and then boom, COVID. It's hard to organize people and show up in masses and do protests when it's a pandemic. So definitely gonna talk about different strategies regarding that as well. So it's exciting.
Last question for you. So I do know you're still in college, so it's completely okay if you don't have the answer for this, but where do you see yourself in 5 to 10 years?
Ooh, okay, that is interesting. I mean, I know I'm going to go to grad school just because at RPI, I'm an STS major. RPI is an engineering school, so I realized I did not want to be an engineer a little bit too late, but we'll see how that plays out. But overall, I do want to be involved in some sort of public policy, community-based either organization or outreach. Even when I'm in grad school, like, I want to be doing something to help the communities for wherever I go to school. And even here at RPI, I think it's so important that Troy isn't just a place where kids can just come and go and just, I was there for a little bit. Like, there are issues in Troy that, especially, like, and in the greater capital region, if you're going to talk about, like, Norlite and all these different, like, you see social issues, you see, obviously, the Hudson River isn't in great shape. And it's not specific to just each community. There are major issues that affect people's livelihoods. And, you know, I'm from a working class family, like deeply working class. Like, my grandfather started a labor union on Long Island. And I think working class rights is very important, along with, of course, other marginalized groups. So kind of whatever I want to do is definitely going to be based in advocacy. And as like part of my degree is with like social research. So also like understanding like societally, okay, like why are these issues happening, and doing research based in that possibly, but then also using that research to inform policy and actually make sure that the taxpayers, people who live in these communities, are being supported. Because like logically, if we just want to think about it logically, if we want to use a little engineering mindset, it does not make sense to not have like sustainable options, to have legislators that actually represent and support their communities. It doesn't make sense to me at all. And it just makes me so angry.
You can register to attend the Youth Congress event at sustainablefuturesconference.com.
Tune in next week to hear another interview with more people contributing to the Youth Congress event.
The Water Justice Fellows will also be a part of the Youth Congress on Climate Justice, which will be taking place from April 27th to 28th, part of the Sustainable Futures Conference. Again, that website for all the information is sustainablefuturesconference.com.
Poet, actor, playwright, and stage director Carol Durant has not only been producing her own work, but encouraging the work of many, many others in the Capital Region with her Outliers Poetry Brunch and work with the Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York. HMM correspondent Meg Marone sat down with Carol to talk about her life in the arts. This is part one of a two-part interview.
We're here with Carol Durant, who is the founder of the Outliers Poetry Brunch and the author of Whole Fat and Gluten-Free Poetry and Cold Pressed and Just Brewed Poetry. And Carol, you were just telling me that you have a pandemic journal that just came out as well.
Hi, Meg. Thanks to you and everyone at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Hope you all are well and staying safe out there. I created a journal book that's blank inside. It's called Pandemic Pads, just so people can have a place where they can write their thoughts, because we've had a very hard year and a half. For some people it was harder than others, and a lot of people have just maybe ignored in some way, shape, or form of, you know, how they're feeling and getting in touch with who they are. So I created the journal just so you would have a place to put your thoughts. It's Pandemic Pads Journal for the Vaccinated. Now, again, that doesn't mean that the unvaccinated person can't buy the book, but I wanted to have a focus because a lot of people, their anticipation for or against, their thoughts about, you know, standing and waiting and obtaining the vaccine, I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on in your mind, and that doesn't mean you need to put it anywhere, but you should put it somewhere, not just ignore it. And once you get it out, you may feel better
about everything that's been going on, whether it's today or previously to today. So, and it's available on Amazon.
In terms of creative expression, it's funny because before the pandemic, the thing that I've appreciated about you the most is the way that you encourage people. So even with the journal, it's about encouraging other people's creative expression. And I'm just wondering how that has happened throughout your life and why you feel so strongly, like even the name Outliers Poetry Brunch, it implies that in some ways you see that no one's really an outlier, that we're all welcome and that we all have license to our creative expression. So just interested in how that encouragement of other people has come up throughout your life and what inspired you to do Outliers.
People are here. We're human beings. And in the light of what's been going on in the world, politics, religion, all of the taboo topics, that you really need to have a place to be. And Outliers is somewhere that whoever you are as a human being, you are welcome to be. And a lot of people may not necessarily feel that they are part of a unit. And everybody is a part. We're a part of the human race. And Outliers was created after talking with myself, starting. And I was able to have the venue at Eden Cafe, and thanks to Joe Ventura for allowing me to have the opportunity to have people who are very creative and funny and skilled, and they are just people that no one knew, and they personally may not have felt that they had the aforementioned, but they are. They're those funny, skilled, positive, maybe even have a negative day or two or eight, which is fine. But Outliers is for people who have a place and a safe place to express themselves. And the opportunity arose that I could do it on a monthly basis. It started out, as I said, in person. And unfortunately, during the pandemic, we had to go online. But technology availed us of the opportunity to use the online and keep it going, and that's what I've been doing. And keeping in touch with people, making sure that they're okay, because the pandemic has not made everything okay. Unfortunately, people have passed. Unfortunately, we can't have human contact just by hugging. And those are the basic things. We can't honor our loved one who has passed by attending their funeral. So for me, Outliers is a place where we can keep people connected. And some of the people that I've met, I didn't think that they had a connection. They absolutely do. And I'm glad that I've met them.
Well, you know, I was just thinking when you were talking about how people like Lucille Clifton, Wallace Stevens. Lucille Clifton worked in a state government building her whole life, and then she would just write on the side. Wallace Stevens famously hated his job as an insurance salesman, and then he would be writing. So I think that that's another thing that I've loved about Outliers, is just the way that you're reminding people that people have day jobs, people have lives, and that doesn't mean that because you're not doing something creative, filling that passion 24/7, that you're still not a creative person. And with what you were just saying about Zoom, it feels like Outliers is even more important, because if we don't have the hugs, then really we have words. And that's what we have.
And thankfully, technology, regardless of whether you've used Zoom or WebEx or Microsoft Teams or Google, everybody has tried it, and some people still don't like it to today. But to know that they have the opportunity to actually reach out, see people, have conversation with people, and in the terms of Outliers, be able to listen to other people's creativity and what they've been doing and how they've been feeling, it's been absolute lovely experience.
And some people haven't had good days, but just by putting that out there in the world that they haven't had a good day, other people identify and the conversation spurs a friendship, you know, off channel, and people can go, oh, I can meet up with you eventually, socially distant, or via Zoom, or, you know, your phone, FaceTime, to have that conversation that, oh, we have a lot more in common, and I never would have met you. Instead, I met you via online, and I look forward to meeting you in person. So it's definitely about the connection.
Yeah, I've seen people give monologues. So actually, yeah, thinking about that, what do you see as the connection between your work with Outliers and also your work in theater? Because you do, you have done, I know it's been different in the pandemic, but you have done work in theater.
Well, I'm a poet and now a playwright, an actor, and stage manager. The playwriting came to fruition from the first two, and I've worked with different theaters and directors in the Capital Region. That's been great. Most recently, I've worked for myself, which has been, thankfully, I've had Jean-Remy Monet as a mentor amongst the many. He's the founder of the Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York, and he's ultra fabulous person who I've learned so much from him. And theater wise, he's encouraging whatever it is, you can do it. If you don't know how, then we'll figure out how to do it and you can do it. He gives you the tools and the encouragement. He's like, sure, you can be a stage manager. You've acted. Absolutely, you can write a play. You're a poet. I'm a challenge accepted Gemini. So working and casting and understanding what all of the back of the house people do, stage managers, directors, the lighting crew, the set, the prop people, you know, costuming, makeup, all of those people, they're extra scoops of fabulousness. When you are the one person who is doing it yourself and can't do it on a stage in person, have to adapt using technology such as Zoom, is unbelievably hard, but it's been a positive all the way around. I had a couple of plays that I was able to do online, and it was a great experience, and I enjoyed all the cast and the time that everybody put in. You know, I'd rather be on stage in person, of course, but the geographic hurdle was wiped out. I had people who, they live across the country and the world, who were able to see my work because, again, there's a pandemic. So in a negative, positives have happened. That's one thing that, of the many positives that we can, you know, search, observe, and be thankful that there's positives in the negative.
That was Carol Durant speaking with Meg Marone, HMM's Megan Marone. And for more information on Carol and her writing, including excerpts from her book, Cold Pressed and Just Brewed Poetry, visit planetcaroldurant.com. And stay tuned. Next week, we'll be bringing you part two of this interview.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.